image, unlike the competing image of a crystal sphere surrounding us, is open to reinterpretation by taking the flow as around on the same plane as the Earth's surface rather than at a steep angle to that plane. Greek okeanos, or ocean, for example, clearly came to be interpreted both ways. Once you can recognize the constellations under any circumstances, a potentially enlightening event awaits you. For as the moon blots out the sun's disk in a total eclipse of the sun, the constellations and planets briefly become visible, all in their proper order. This is instant proof that the stars flow perpetually around the Earth. Even without eclipses, it also becomes clear that things move at different speeds. All the stars at one speed, and the sun, moon, and planets each at yet other speeds. All these cycles can, of course, be watched and counted. Some of the planets, in addition to their own speeds, have strange courses, seeming to back up east to west for a while, retrograde, before forging ahead again, as though with wills that are independent, even ornery. The sun, moon, and planets, literally wanderers, must therefore be deities, willfulness principle, and pretty major ones at that. And somebody up there must be in charge of all that motion. The moving finger writes, and having writ, moves on. Edward Fitzgerald, The Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, 1879. Being the farthest away of the five planets visible to the naked eye, Saturn has the longest cycle, taking almost 30 Earth years, 29.46 to be exact, to orbit the Sun once, sidereal period. Saturn's orbit is therefore the longest single measure of time readily available in the sky. And the myths of Saturn, whatever his name, Kronos, Wiracocha, Ea, Enki, Ptah, etc., present him as the lord of measures, measurer of time. Jupiter, rather closer, takes not quite 12 Earth years, 11.86, to circle the sun. As they orbit, Jupiter and Saturn appear to come together in the sky once every 20 years. This meeting is called a planetary conjunction and is easily recognizable and countable. But each time they encounter each other, they appear against a different third of the zodiac, so that it takes them 60 years to reappear together in about the same spot among the background of stars. They actually overshoot a little, so their conjunctions move slowly through the zodiac by triple bounces in the same direction as the sun moves through it during the year. It takes 40 conjunctions, hence about 800 years, for Saturn and Jupiter to meet in exactly the same spot in the sky as before. These numbers, especially 40, 60, and 800, along with 12 noted earlier, keep turning up in mythology. Viewed geometrically, it takes one angle of this triangle, or trigon, 3 times 800, which equals 2400 years, to move all the way around the zodiac. So Jupiter, whatever his name, Zeus, Pirua, Manco Capac, Marduk, etc., as the junior member of the team, takes the measures from Saturn, allowing a systematically marked calendrical count to build up from 20 to 60 to 800 to 2400 years and beyond. Mars is next, orbiting in 687 days, but because Earth moves at the same time, it takes 780 days, the synodic period, a bit over 2 Earth years, for Mars to end up in the same place in our sky again. Vividly encoded, the Finnish superboy Kullervo, first seen in a cradle lowered from heaven, barked 1 year, another one, a little from the third, at the smith Ilmarinen, maker of the continuously turning celestial mill. The reddish color of Mars seems to have caused association with blood, hence with war and war gods. The last two planets, Venus and Mercury, whiz around the Sun in less than a year, 225 and 88 days, because they lie between us and the Sun. Since we would have to look right into the Sun to find them much of the time, we can only see them during a total eclipse or when they happen to be off to one side near dawn and dusk as morning stars or evening stars. Then they are lit by the Sun from the side and appear through a telescope as less than full circles, crescent, half, or gibbous, humpbacked, just like the Moon. But certainly for Mercury, which is so near the Sun from our perspective that it's hard to see anyway, visible only during twilight and close to the horizon, those phases are impossible to see with the naked eye. The same is said for Venus. Venus, quite unlike Mercury, is by far the brightest object in the entire sky, other than the Sun and Moon, shining even during the day sometimes. We have spotted it at 4:30 p.m. It hovers for almost 9 months as the bright and beautiful evening star, 9 more as the morning star heralding dawn, with alternately 1 week and 7 weeks of invisibility between stints, totaling a 19.5-month synodic period. This seems to be the only planet ever thought to be a female deity, Aphrodite Helen, Ishtar Inanna, Anahita Anahid, Surye, daughter of Surya, the Sun. The name is etymologically the same as Helene, etc. As a goddess among gods, and the most beautiful of all, surely Venus will be remembered by amorous liaisons as she moves about the sky. None other than Homer recounts a silly story in which Hephaestus, tipped off by Helios, or the Sun, catches his wife Aphrodite, or Venus, in bed with Ares, or Mars. Enraged, he casts an invisible net that holds them while he appeals to Zeus, or Jupiter, Hermes, or Mercury, Poseidon and Apollo, to come around and laugh at them, until Poseidon gravely persuades him to let them go. If the planets are gods, this stellar event, which has to have occurred before Homer, around 800 BC, and after Zeus became celestial ruler, around 2150 BC, as we'll see below, must encode a massing of all 5 visible planets. So we looked for it. One and only one such massing has occurred in the last 5,000 years. A truly memorable event to longtime skywatchers, one also noted in Chinese myth. It was visible just before sunrise throughout what we would call late February, 1953 BC. Homer carries baggage far older than the Trojan War. Santayana and Deccan, in 1969, first suggested this myth was astronomical, proposing a simple conjunction of Venus and Mars in the Pleiades, perhaps seen as a net. That occurs frequently each century and doesn't explain the other central details. But they had no way to check their hypotheses. Fortunately, new planetarium-type software, we used Redshift and Starry Night Pro, enables anyone to generate the dates of planetary events and watch them run through time as viewed from a particular location. We chose Athens for convenience. Sullivan had to persuade operators of a mechanical planetarium to check a few key hypotheses. Happily, they were correct. Being able to use a PC revolutionizes star myth research. So, Sun, Moon, planets, and stars appear to circle the Earth at various speeds, rising or being born in the east, and setting or dying in the west each day or night, and being completely invisible for varying periods of time. We have now dollied around to the right camera angle to see that if celestial bodies die in the west, the Sun at dusk, shrouded by night, and the stars and planets during the night, then the west is an appropriate direction to travel to find the abode of the dead. But since the dying celestial bodies are easily construed as passing under the earth to rise or be reborn again hours later, the land of the dead must also lie underneath the earth, and may well be lit by the sun, moon, and stars while they are down there. The nether location of the dead is, of course, reinforced by the fact that most human cultures put their dead under the earth, that is, the soil. Modern scholars complain that the ancient Greeks and others vacillated as to whether one reached the land of the dead by going west or heading straight down. They missed the point. By this widespread cosmology, it was clearly in both places at once. Thus, both pharaohs and Greek heroes could quite plausibly sail west to reach the underworld, just as the sun and stars do. But if the bright celestial lights we call sun, moon, and planets are willful, then one could conclude, and many cultures did, that the stars are lesser wills, namely the disembodied souls of ordinary people and perhaps animals waiting to be reborn. How then might they get back and forth? One could presumably dispatch a dead soul quickly back to its home among the astral fires above by cremation. The Norse, in fact, often hedged their bets by cremating important persons, flame rising to flame, in a launched ship, sailing to the ocean of stars. In the Andes, as William Sullivan in 1996 has shown at length, souls were thought to cross between worlds at the moment when the sun did its standstill or solstice rising and setting in the Milky Way. One would wonder about this obsessive concern with the stars and their motion, were it not the case that those early thinkers thought they had located the gods which rule the universe, and with it also the destiny of the soul down here and after death. Santayana and Descant, 1969. The path of the zodiac and planets is not the only circular motion observable in the night sky. The bright star path of the Milky Way, in actuality a side view of our own galaxy, from Greek galact, milk, appears to stretch between Gemini, Taurus at one end and Scorpio, Sagittarius at the other, and to swing around the sky as the year progresses. Two more animal constellations, the Big Bear and Little Bear, also known as Big and Little Dipper or Spoon, or Big and Little Wane or Wagon, go round and round each other in the northern sky like the sides of a mill wheel, from the viewpoint of people in the northern hemisphere, without ever disappearing into the underworld the way the sun, moon, and most stars do. Eternal and undying, they seem to circle round an invisible axis or shaft termed the celestial pole. At the top end of that shaft today we see the star Polaris, or North Star, the one star which appears immobile, thereby defining the direction north. This central axis or shaft around which both earth and sky, space and time are organized, predictably figures widely in mythology. It may be analogized as a world tree, like Norse Yggdrasil, with heaven above, our earthly living space midway, and another more mysterious realm below, or the Central Asian shaman's tree, which gives access to the multi-layered spirit world, or Zeus's oak, carrying the star mantle, or as the axle of a cosmic mill, like the Finnic Sampo, or the Germanic mill of Amlodi, Amethyst, Hamlet, or Frothi's Grotta, the crusher, that grinds out stars, salt, and sand in turn, or as the shaft of a churn continually stirring the ocean of milk, depicted often in Asia and carefully architecturalized at Angkor Thom, or as all manner of ominous spindles, oars, steep mountains, pillars, and posts. If we now imagine the earth as round with a pole through it, we can either picture the earth as a disc or ball turning on this axis amid a cloud of stars, our current theory, or imagine a giant starry sphere or river that turns or flows around us, an older theory corresponding more closely to how things look. If a sphere, then the stars, which move at one speed, must be affixed to a different crystalline sphere from sun, moon, and planets, which move at different paces, and so must each have its own concentric crystal sphere. There must then be at least seven of these, carrying sun, moon, and the five visible planets, Saturn, Jupiter, Mars, Venus, and Mercury. Imagining that the seven heavenly bodies simply guided their boats along a stream of stars produced a rather simpler, if less deterministic, theory. But the Pythagorean notion of crystal spheres carrying myriad fires persisted in Western thought into the Renaissance. Halfway from where the pole emerges at Earth's top, north, and bottom, south, we can also imagine slicing in two both the Earth ball and the surrounding crystal spheres, like cutting an onion in half. This cut line marks the Earth's equator, and where it slices the apparent sphere of the heavens surrounding us, the celestial equator. This cutting plane, the plane of the celestial equator, forms a 90-degree angle with the line of the pole or axis, but because the Earth doesn't sit up straight, both lie at a rakish 23.5-degree angle to the plane of the ecliptic where the sun and planets are. It is tipped a bit on its side as it circles the sun, such that when the north half is facing the sun more directly, the northern hemisphere experiences summer and the southern winter. The moment of maximum tip toward the sun marks the summer solstice, when daylight lasts longest, and the maximum tip away defines the winter solstice, when days are shortest. Halfway between these moments, we get the equinoxes, from Latin for equal night, when night and day last exactly 12 hours each, and the sun rises and sets due east and west. To look at it another way, at the equinoxes, the sun shines directly down on the equator, the halfway point of its apparent north-south movement. But at the summer solstice, when its course appears to turn from moving north to moving south, its rays shine straight down on the Tropic of Cancer, 23.5 degrees north of the equator, and at the winter solstice, when it turns north again, on the Tropic of Capricorn, at 23.5 degrees south latitude. Now, the solstices are the easiest part of the calendar for a novice to observe, since the point of sunrise seems to stand still for a few days. But once one understands and can locate the celestial equator and the ecliptic, the equinoxes become more accurate calendrical markers. They lie at the points where the two circles cross. This image of crossing graphically symbolized the equinox and/or solstice in many cultures. Just as the solstices and equinoxes mark time, so they also help humans orient themselves in space. Imagine yourself back in the era with no electricity, clocks, wheels, or cities. It also had no roads, no AAA maps, no compasses. How do you find north or true east? The sun's shadow can give you a rough idea, but the stars are far more accurate. The Egyptians of 2500 BC located exact north by clever observation of star alignments around the celestial pole to orient their pyramids. Also, the sun rises and sets at the equinoxes at points due east and west, and north-south runs perpendicular to the line between those points. But how do you find any of that on some other day of the year, especially if you are a traveler, someone with no permanent markers? The trick is to learn when and where the stars rise and set, not just alone, but as a system. Within it, the constellations in which the sun rises and sets at the summer and winter solstices mark at that time the farthest north and south that the sun ever moves, with east-west halfway between, providing another set of four benchmarks from which time and direction could be reckoned. Stones set up at Stonehenge and elsewhere mark these key positions. In a world before magnetic compasses, roads, and signposts, such celestial sightings were critical for travel in general and navigation in particular. But eventually we run into trouble. Suppose you have inherited a myth telling you that the sun rises at the summer solstice where you see the constellation Leo the Lion, and the spring equinox sun rises in Taurus the Bull. Yet, as you watch the sun year after year, you find it shifting ever so slowly out of these constellations into the next ones, Cancer and Aries. And furthermore, the end of the rotational axis no longer sits in quite the same section of the sky as before. North has moved. What a catastrophe! Not so much for the calendar, but for navigation, since all the coordinates marking direction must now be reestablished. Travelers, remember, don't have fixed chin rests, but depend on celestial markers. In fact, such a celestial shift actually happens. The fixed stars aren't quite fixed. This slippage results from a wobble in the Earth's rotation, like the wobble of a top at the end of its spin, that causes the end of the tipped pole to wander in a huge, slow circle through the northern stars. When the Egyptians built the pyramids around 2500 BC, the sky rotated not around Polaris at the end of the Little Dipper, but around Thuban, a brightish star in nearby Draco the Dragon. After that, there was no pole star for millennia. The position of the pole could only be reckoned from nearby configurations. The change in where the axis points also causes the sunrise at the equinoxes and solstices to move exceedingly slowly against the backdrop of the zodiac. In fact, it takes nearly 26,000 years to complete the cycle, a rate of 2,160 years per zodiacal sector. If these are allotted and equal 30 degrees apiece, 12 times 30 degrees equals 360 degrees, and 12 times 2,160 equals 25,920. As the pole wobbles, the positions of the equinoxes and solstices slide slowly through the zodiac in the opposite direction from everything else. Thus, the sun currently moves from a background of Gemini to Cancer during July, but about 2,000 years ago, the June solstice slid the opposite way, from Cancer into Gemini. Since the astrological system used by our newspapers was fossilized more than 2,000 years ago, most people are misinformed as to the constellation that ruled the sun when they were born. Thus, if your birthday is July 4th, you were actually born when the sun was in Gemini, not Cancer. Because this slow wobble is, from our monthly point of view, in the direction of the preceding constellation, the phenomenon is now known as the precession of the equinoxes, but it might be better called the shift of celestial north, or north shift. In mythology, it had other names. Several other names, in fact, according to the analogies used to describe and remember this difficult yet crucial navigational information. How, for example, might one encode the relentless precession if one habitually described the heavens as rotating around a pole, whether as mill, drill, spindle, or churn? Surely some evil force, that is, some will working against the assigned order of things, is knocking the rotating fire drill or mill wheel axle off its socket. Worldwide, the original owner of this vulnerable mill turns out to be Saturn, he who first gave the measures of the universe. And the mill shaft's unseating results in some mythologies in a vast open whirlpool or maelstrom in both sky above and ocean below. Those interested in these widespread myths can peruse the data collected by Santayana and Deccand in their book Hamlet's Mill. Its proper seat is the navel of the world. Thus, Cuzco, name of the great Inca astronomical center, means navel, and the Greeks viewed Apollo's temples as the navel of the world, both the shrine at Delphi on Mount Parnassus and that on Delos, center of the Cycladic Wheel Islands. Two navels in one culture? Surely another doublet syncretized from pre-Hellenic times. Or suppose the image is a canopy or roof propped up by the pillars of the world, usually four, although among Eurasian nomads, analogically to their own architecture, the sky is viewed as upheld by a central tent pole, the world axis. Then some great, Samson-like force comes and pulls down the pillars of the house, which will have to be reestablished. One has to wonder whether the cult pillars of the Minoans signified the vulnerable pillars of the earth, marked as they are with stars and with double axe signs resembling the common equinoctial, solstitial sign. Santayana and Deccand describe explicitly what this earth is that modern interpreters like to take for a pancake. Earth is the implied plane through the four points of the year, marked by the equinoxes and solstices. In other words, the ecliptic. And this is why this earth is very frequently said to be quadrangular. The four corners, that is, the zodiacal constellations rising heliacally at both the equinoxes and solstices, are the points which determine an earth. Every world age has its own earth. It is for this very reason that ends of the world are said to take place. A new earth arises when another set of zodiacal constellations brought in by the procession determines the year points. Or take as a starting point the river of stars, flowing in endless circles round and round the earth from the unseen celestial reservoirs below. A male llama, who was pastured on a hill with excellent fodder, knew that the mother sea had decided to overflow. This llama became very sad. He kept crying out, "In! In!" and didn't eat. The llama's master, very angry, hit him with an ear of maize. "Eat, dog," he said. "You are lying about on the best pastures." Then the llama, speaking as if he were a man, told the shepherd, "Pay very close attention, and remember what I am going to tell you. 5 days from now the great ocean will be here, and the whole world will be flooded." And the shepherd was stricken with fear. "We will go somewhere to escape. Let us go to Mount Vilcacato. There we must save ourselves. Bring food for 5 days," he ordered. And so from that instant he started walking, taking his family and the llama. When he was about to reach the top of Mount Vilcacato, he found that all the animals were reunited. Puma, fox, guanaco, condor, every species of animal. Hardly had the man arrived than the water began to fall in rivers. And so there they were, squeezed together at the top of the Vilcacato, in a very tiny space, at the very peak, where the water couldn't quite reach. But the water did manage to reach Fox's tail and get it wet, which is why Fox's tail to this day is black. And after 5 days, the waters began to recede and dry up. From Sullivan, 1996. Just as in Genesis, this tale, collected in two versions in the Andes in the 16th century, concludes with the entire world being repopulated by the man, his family, and the huddled animals, the sole survivors of the flood. But this flood is located on the opposite side of the globe from the Near East, and other similar tales come from India, Greece, Indonesia, China, and so on. Consulting geologists is futile, as the second Andean version warns us, As the waters rose, the hill grew higher, so that it was never covered by the flood, and when the waters subsided, the hill also grew smaller. No earthly hill can do that. The flood is not earthly, but celestial, and we must abandon seeking specific geographic sites for it, except by attraction. The fox's tail warns us, too, where to look, since in Chapter 14 we learned that Fox is an Andean constellation, slipping tail first down the hill and below the horizon into the water, the celestial river. Then again, recall that it was a boat constellation that carried Isis and Osiris to safety during a global deluge. In short, although stories of actual floods may have attracted themselves repeatedly to this myth, such as the 6th millennium Black Sea flood, the flood is at heart astronomical, and specifically recounts north shift and the precession of the equinoxes, when one set of cardinal constellations, pushed by the multitudes behind it, falls below the horizon into the surrounding celestial sea, while another set rises triumphant to replace it. You can refer to Santayana and Deccan for worldwide coverage. The usual reason for the flood is crowding multitudes. Which constellation is crowded into the drink, however, depends, of course, on the date and whether seen from the northern or southern hemisphere. And because the world afterwards is much the same as before, clearly, and here is the movie construct principle, enough humans and animals survive to repopulate. Suppose, however, that the dominant image for the starry sky is that of circulating fire of some sort, shining perhaps through little holes in the vault, and the sun through a big hole. Then one could predict that a collapse of the old system would bring down a rain of fire, destroying the old world. Yet the net effect is the same as with the flood, since the regenerated world, rising phoenix-like from its own ashes, resembles the previous one. The Norse prediction of the death of the gods at Ragnarok, made famous by Wagner's apocalyptically fiery opera, Götterdämmerung, includes passages asserting that each god who dies in battle, when heaven is rent asunder by the fiery hordes, will be replaced by another. At that time, earth will rise out of the sea and be green and fair. Vidar, having killed the wolf that swallows Odin, and Vali will be living, so neither the sea nor Surt's fire will have done them injury, and they will inhabit Idavul, where Asgard used to be, and the sons of Thor will come there and possess Mjolnir. While the world is being burnt by Surt, in a place called Hadmimir's Wood, will be concealed two human beings, and from these will come men after men. And you will think this strange, but the sun will have borne a daughter no less lovely than herself, and she will follow the paths of her mother. Gylfaginning. Compare this with a passage in the ancient royal Hawaiian Kumulipo, spotted by Santayana and Deccan. Now turns the swinging of time over the burnt-out world. Back goes the great turning of things upwards again, as yet sunless, the time of shrouded light. From out Makali'i, the Pleiades, night-dark veil of cloud, thrills shadow-like the prefiguration of the world to be. Vikings and Polynesians alike, both adept at sailing huge distances without modern maps and instruments, paid close attention to the destruction and birth of systems of celestial coordinates. We do not. The tropics of Cancer and Capricorn became the tropics, sun-turning points, of Gemini and Sagittarius 2,000 years ago. But having become seriously literate before that, we never bothered to change the names on our maps. In fact, without myth to encode and transmit the critical data, pre-literate societies would be hard-pressed to know that precession out of one constellation into the next both had occurred and would occur again on a regular schedule. For if precession moves 30 degrees in 2,160 years, it takes 72 years to move a single degree, about twice the apparent diameter of the moon, a rate so slow as to be barely discernible within a single lifetime. How far back, then, was the phenomenon of north shift or precession noticed, even if not understood? Ask astronomers, and they'll state firmly that a Greek named Hipparchus first figured it out in about 128 BC and calculated its cycle at about 36,000 years. This is rather on the long side of the actual 25,920 years, but a small error of observation becomes enormous when one has to calculate so huge a number from a short time of measuring. Soon after Hipparchus died, the mystery cult of Mithras began to spread across the Roman Empire, presently becoming the chief rival to Christianity. The focal point of each Mithraic temple was a depiction of the god Mithras slaying a bull, with many other symbols around the edges, such as the sun and moon, torchbearers, dog, snake, crow, sometimes a lion and a cup, and oddest of all, a scorpion beneath the bull. But this is the zodiac, for when one equinox is in Taurus the bull, the other lies in Scorpio, and the solstices in Leo and Aquarius the cupbearer. In fact, a recent book by David Ulansey on the origins of the Mithraic mysteries patiently ferrets out the tightly interlocked astral significance of each and every detail in those reliefs, and they are all celestial. The central motif, then, must signify that the god Mithras, in slaying Taurus, had the power to move the entire heavens off their coordinates, causing the sun, at spring equinox, to leave Taurus. As Ulansey remarks, a god with that much power was a god to reckon with. For the possession of carefully guarded secret knowledge concerning such a mighty divinity would naturally have been experienced as assuring privileged access to the favors which this god could grant, such as deliverance from the forces of fate residing in the stars, and protection for the soul after death during its journey through the planetary spheres. Now, precession out of Taurus into Aries occurred nearly 2,000 years before Mithraism became popular, and Ulansey casts about vainly to find good reasons for this archaic imagery, knowing Hipparchus to be the first discoverer of precession. But note that this sudden popularity immediately precedes the next precession from Aries into Pisces in 6 BC. Clearly, some Near Eastern group already knew another shift was coming. Other evidence supports this conclusion. If Hipparchus were really first, why is it that much older Babylonian texts are working with numbers like 2160 and 4,320, precisely the rather peculiar numbers of years associated with precession? People will tell you Copernicus was the first to realize the Earth goes around the Sun instead of Sun around Earth. Yet we have documentation that certain Pythagorean philosophers in the late centuries BC developed a heliocentric view of the cosmos. This notion was then lost until Copernicus came along nearly 2,000 years later. Since, as the geologists say, what did happen can happen, since key ideas did, and therefore can get lost for a while, let's assume for the moment that Hipparchus could have been second comer. Then from his ambush the sun reached out his left hand, and with his right he took the gigantic sickle, long and jagged-toothed, and from his very own father he swiftly lopped the genitals and threw them behind him. Hesiod, Theogony. The emasculation of Uranus by his son Cronos is one of the many violent episodes in ancient Greek and Near Eastern tales of how the gods battled for possession of kingship in heaven. According to Hesiod, after the primeval chaos came Earth, unfaltering foundation of all, along with murky Tartarus, the under half of the world, and Night and Erebus. Erebus and Night united to produce day and ether, the bright upper air. Then Earth produced Uranus, the sphere of the sky, such that he might cover her on all sides, to be the unfaltering seat for the blessed gods always. Uranus next begat various children on Earth, but he hated them, we learn, and as soon as they were born, he would hide them away and not let them out into the light. For this evil act, Earth plotted his downfall, producing a sickle of gray adamantine, often translated flint, but literally unconquerable, and begging her children to wreak vengeance. Cronos, the youngest, took up the challenge and the sickle, ambushing his father at nightfall and emasculating him. Cronos then assumed kingship in heaven, and with his sister wife Rhea, begat Hestia, Demeter, Hera, Hades, Poseidon, and finally Zeus. But great Cronos swallowed each of them down, as each fell to the knees of its sacred mother from the womb, intending thus that no other, none of the illustrious descendants of Uranus, should hold the kingly power among the immortal gods. But as Zeus was about to be born, Rhea begged her parents, Earth and Uranus, for help against Cronus's child abuse. Earth hid the newborn Zeus in a Cretan cave, while Rhea swaddled a stone and gave that to Cronos to gulp down in place of Zeus. Zeus grew strong, nourished, as we learn elsewhere, by the goat Amalthea and her horn of plenty, then vanquished his father, became the next king of heaven, and forced Cronos to disgorge his five siblings. First up, Cronos vomited the stone he had swallowed down last, and Zeus planted it down on the wide-pathed earth at holy Pytho, Delphi, under the hollows of Parnassus, to be a sign thereafter, a marvel to mortal men. To the Greeks, Zeus was still king of heaven in their time, but a rather jumpy king, since Prometheus was said to know the secret of a goddess who would bear a son stronger than his father. A vivid story indeed. But what's it all about? These myths say they record long-term changes in heaven. The reference to Delphi confirms which change. Delphi, navel of the world. Delphi, on pillar-steep Mount Parnassus, where Deucalion and Pyrrha, the survivors of the Aegean version of the flood, landed. Delphi, where the old order was unseated and the world renewed by Apollo, destroyer of the snaky dragon Pytho. All the details spell precession, that is, north shift. The myth, moreover, recounts the precession not once, but twice at least. When Zeus came to power, as the spring equinox came from Taurus into Aries around 2150 BC, and when Cronos vanquished Uranus, as the equinox moved from Gemini into Taurus around 4300 BC. Time out. When the spring equinox was in Gemini, the fall equinox was in Sagittarius, and the Milky Way, which spans the sky between them, formed a pathway of stars or souls aligned with the cardinal points, making it easy for the souls to move to and fro, conversing with the gods. Truly a golden age. Later, when the sky had moved as far as the Third Age, one needed a bridge across the gap, or perhaps a boatman to ferry souls to their destination. In the Golden Age, the summer solstice was in Virgo. As the Fourth World Age started, 6,500 years after the Golden Age began, the fall equinox moved into Virgo, once again placing a pillar of the world in that quarter. When Saturn and Jupiter came into great conjunction in Pisces in 6 BC, everyone who still understood the old lore and images, the Magi, Persian wise men or astrologers, Pythagoreans and Virgil alike, took that moment as marking the procession into Pisces and the advent of a new king of heaven to rule the new age. Now comes the final age of the Cumaean song. The great succession of ages is born anew. Now the Virgin herself returns. The Saturnian reign returns. Now a new generation is sent down from high heaven. On the boy being born, under whom first the race of iron will cease, and a golden race arise throughout the world, smile, chaste Lucina. Virgil, Fourth Eclogue. Iam redit et Virgo. Now the Virgin returns. On the strength of this passage, with its Virgin and Child, the upcoming Christians, whose creed made knowledge of star deities subversive, dubbed Virgil an honorary Christian, whom Dante could take as spiritual guide to the underworld. Such is the power of restructuring. But it tells us why we no longer know any of this ancient lore. Christianity wiped its significance out of our culture. Structurally similar stories of the change of kingship in heaven were told by Babylonians, Hittites, and Phoenicians, by Germanic and Finnic tribes, and across Eurasia to Iran, India, and China. All must have diffused ultimately from the ancient Near East, since the details match far too well for coincidence. If we line up the participants according to their deeds, we see at least two clear turnovers, corresponding to Uranus ceding to Kronos, and Kronos to Zeus. These would have to correspond to the summer solstice moving from Virgo to Leo, then to Cancer, and spring equinox from Gemini to Taurus, then to Aries. That the Virgin returned as one of the four cardinal constellations in the precession of 6 BC, returning the world to the original golden age of man, makes full sense in this light, and only thus. One day we'll consign it to an end, and the bulky structure of the universe, upheld through many years, will rush to ruin. Lucretius, De Rerum Natura. So the existence of precession was known and mythologized by some cultures before the constellational shift, circa 4300 BC, a Stone Age date that differs little from the latest date by which the Egyptian calendar must have been set up, 4241 BC. At that point, people in the Near East would have been settled down with permanent chin rests, more than long enough to notice that their alignments, set up to work out a solar calendar after the invention of agriculture, were sliding relentlessly out of whack. To those for whom the stars were immutable, this realization must have been shattering. The very frame of the sky moved, however slow the wheels. The ancients vacillated as to whether the appropriate mythical analogy for precession should be reciprocating motion, as with the churn or fire drill, which turns one way, then an equal amount back, or continuous rotary motion, as with the mill wheels and spindles. Indic myth opted for reciprocation, mythologizing the churn and fire drill, whereas Plato, following the Pythagoreans, the Greek inheritors of the deep astronomical tradition, chose rotation, citing the spindle turning on the lap of necessity in the Republic. As did Germanic and Finnic myths with their periodically upset mill wheels, and the Harappans with Shiva's recurrent whirling dance of world destruction. The problem was that although people had been noting precession through several stages of the zodiac, so they knew the frame turned and knew roughly how fast, they had observed considerably less than half a cycle, 13,000 years, so they didn't know if it would keep going or turn back. Several scholars suggest that some myth-tellers not only knew of the precession, but even had a close idea of its cycle. It moves 1 degree in 72 years, 30 degrees or a 12th of the zodiac in 2,160 years, and the entire circle in 25,920 years, 72 times 360 degrees. These suspicions arise because of the numbers associated with flood myths. For example, the five approaches to Angkor Thom in Cambodia, constructed as a cosmic map, each depict 54 gods and 54 demons, 540 in all, tugging on the serpent cord wrapped around the celestial mountain pillar, represented by the temple, that serves as dasher to churn the milky ocean. 540 times 4 equals 2160. The temple is 12th century, but the story goes back to the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, epics composed 2,500 years ago. Similarly, the Grimnismal says Valhalla has 540 doors, from each of which 800 warriors will emerge at Ragnarok. Remember that the trigon of Saturn and Jupiter, crucial to timekeeping, revolves completely in 800 years. 540 times 800 equals 2,160 times 200 equals 432,000. But 432,000 is the astronomical number of years which Berossos, the Babylonian priest who tried to summarize his country's accumulated wisdom for the conquering Greeks in 281 BC, ascribes to the combined reigns of the 10 mythical kings who preceded the flood. A quarter of that number, 540 times 200, or 2,160 times 50, equals 10,800, the number of stanzas in the Rig Veda, of bricks to be laid in an Indic fire altar, of years said by Heraclitus to constitute an aeon, and so on. These numbers keep recurring. More myth-born evidence of clocking the cycle comes from a cuneiform king list written about 1700 BC that totals the 10 antediluvian kings' reigns at 456,000 years. If Berossos's 432,000 reflects knowledge that it takes 72 years to move 1 degree, then 456,000 would exactly reflect a belief that it takes 75 years. This earlier and slightly less good approximation, amounting to 27,000 years per round rather than 25,920, must then have been refined further before Berossos wrote nearly 1,500 years later. But it is still far better than Hipparchus's crude estimate of 36,000 years, suggesting a much longer period of noting the shift than he had access to. Hipparchus worked almost alone. The Babylonians passed down traditional knowledge in myth over millennia. Everything flows. Heraclitus. Why do the same numbers keep coming up, especially multiples of 6, like 60, 360, and 2160, not to mention 12, 24, 30, 72, 540, 10,800, 432,000, and so on? Most of them turn up in ancient measures of sky and time that diffused widely from the Near East. 12 zodiac constellations, or months in a year, 24 hours in a day, 30 days in a month, 60 minutes in an hour, minutes to a degree, seconds in a minute, 72 years to a degree, 360 degrees in a circle. But in a way, we load the dice in saying it thus, because the Mesopotamians clearly used an arithmetic based as much on 6 as on 10, and we see this as soon as we can read their tablets, around 3000 BC. Presumably, they chose to divide the day into 24 hours, the hour and minute into 60 parts, and the circle into 360 degrees, because they already worked with bases 6, 10, and 60. Base 10 is obvious, 10 fingers. But why base 6, or 60? We need to locate their camera angle. The closest thing to 360 is the year, which both Egyptians and Mesopotamians treated as having 360 days, plus an extra 5-day holiday. But was that slightly forced congruence a cause or an afterthought? Then again, the moon cycles through four quarters in 29.5 days. One could chop it to 28, as we do, evenly quarterable into 7-day weeks, but the extra day and a half will make hash of staying in phase with the moon. Or one could lengthen it to 30, which divides the year nicely into 12 months. 12 times 30 equals 360. But the extra half day will throw the moon phases off, and the year actually has a few more days. In short, 365 days a year doesn't lead clearly to these numbers as sacred. We need a different angle. As part of an attempt to understand the prehistoric system of accounting with shaped clay tokens, Denise Schmand-Besserot summarizes what is known of the cognition and linguistics of simple counting. Briefly, young children and many economically simple societies recognize readily only the numerical abstractions 1, 2, many. Counting above 2 is managed by matching the objects to a pile of counters, pebbles, sticks, notches, whatever. The clay tokens have proved to be just such one-for-one counters, different shapes serving for different commodities, with no means of showing abstract numbers. Numerals seem to turn up exactly when the token system is restructured into the first true writing system shortly before 3000 BC. The Sumerian language itself shows vestiges of the old way, having several different sets of counting words that depend on what is being counted and that contain basic words only for 1, 3, and sometimes 2. Higher numerals are compounded of these, 4 being literally 3-1, 7 being 3-3-1, etc. Despite the invention of number signs, the cuneiform system was about as clumsy as Roman numerals for computation. Try multiplying MCV by XIII. And scribes depended on looking up the needed figures in laboriously compiled tables of numerical relations, such as times tables, to find such things as the areas of plots of land from measurements of two sides. Integers, whole numbers, and integral factors, divisors with no leftover fractions, dominated the approach, avoiding coping directly with fractions. Now, imagine yourself back in that leisurely era with no TV, and contemplate one by one the wonderful qualities of each integer. 1. Unity. 2 and 3 are primes. 4 equals 2 plus 2 and 2 times 2, a square. 5 is prime, also 2 plus 3. But 6 is 3 plus 3, Sumerian 3-3, but also 1 times 2 times 3, all of the first three digits as factors. 7 is prime. 8 is 2 times 2 times 2, the first cube. 9 is 3 times 3, the next square. 10 is 2 times 5. 11 and 13 are primes. But 12 is factorable, evenly divisible, by 1, 2, 3, and 4, the first four digits, as well as by 6. To get to a number with all of the first five digits as factors, you must jump to 60, factorable by 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, plus 6 for good measure, as well as by 10, 12, 15, 20, 30, and of course 60, a whopping 12 possibilities. The next winner in the factor derby is none other than 360, 6 times 60, with 24 possible factors. Surely a number to conjure with, along with 6 and 60. In short, the multiples of 6 and 60 end up being the most flexible for a system accessed by integral factors, and 360 is close to the all-important number of days in the year, is integrally divisible by the roughly 30-day lunar cycle, and so on. The universe now begins to take on orderliness. Humans may then follow divine suit and assign 360 degrees as a measure of the encircling horizon, and assign convenient multiples of 6 to all those other measures of time and space. No one disputes that this handy system diffused across the world. It's why your watch divides time into multiples of 6, whether you buy it in Geneva, Hong Kong, or Los Angeles. Surely, then, number would be a principal manifestation of the divine and permanent, and we are now at the right camera angle to see why the early Greek philosophers who inherited the ancient tradition insisted on this point. Everything around us constantly changes. We are born, grow, and die. The moon waxes and wanes. Tides ebb and flow. Weather shifts. Time and sky move on. But the qualities of number remain constant. That profound insight must go back to the stargazers of proto-literate Mesopotamia. Just as the Royal Hawaiian chants transmit more than a millennium of often verifiable celestial events, so the followers of Pythagoras, Orpheus, Socrates, Plato, Mithras, and others pipe down to us many records of ancient astronomical observation, encoded into mythical language that becomes increasingly clear to those initiates willing to ferret out the deeper-than-surface meanings. We do well not to underestimate the intelligence and knowledge of our remote ancestors. Chapter 17. Prometheus. And with unbreakable shackles, Zeus bound wily Prometheus with painful bonds, driving a shaft through the middle, and he set on him a long-winged eagle, and it ate at his immortal liver, which would grow back exactly as much at night as the spread-winged bird would eat during the whole day. Hesiod, Theogony. Long ago men were hungry and unhappy. They were cold. The only fire in the world was on a mountain top, watched by 3 skookums. They guarded the fire carefully. Men might steal it and become as strong as they. Pacific Northwest Myth. Who would believe this, except that it has age as a witness? Ovid, Metamorphoses. Prometheus holds an important position in the Greek pantheon because he brought fire to mankind, either from heaven or from the forge of Hephaestus, depending on whom you believe. In punishment for this and other outwittings, Zeus chained him to a mountain, tormenting him with an eagle. But if the god of fire is attached to a mountain,